This is Seattle, Washington, November 14th, 1979. This is side one, the second part of two tapes, an interview between Professor Martin Duffy and Christine Miller, research analyst, University of Minnesota Labor Education Service, and myself concerning the Minneapolis General Driver Strikes of 1934.
Now, it seems that the Hawes-Dunnigan Agreement provided that platform workers would be included. Mm-hmm. Well, it was explained that I believe it was Ray Dunn, who said, well, platform workers is a big thing. What's the platform? How far does it go? Comes under the general heading of what's reasonable. That it was explained at the Eagles Hall that day when we voted on the Hawes-Dunnigan Agreement that if we got the drivers and the helpers and the platform workers, the platform would have to include all the first floor people. That's the position the union would take. Now, warehouses those days a little bit different than they are today. Today, warehouses are, for the most part, flat, one level, but they can be used with a forklift. Mm-hmm. The old days, they had warehouses stacked up, one floor on top of the other, and you had an old freight elevator, and you moved a ton at a time on. Mm-hmm. But on the main shipping floor, lots of people were working, and we could argue that the platform was that portion of the workplace, and we felt we'd be able to live with that. Donahue excluded them, if I recall correctly. He said the drivers and the helpers, and he didn't include the platform workers. That's my recollection of it. And that's one of the points that when we went to the meeting to propose the Donahue settlement, that we got the big flack from the men that we were selling somebody short. And that we had lost our guts, so to speak. And I remember I was on the mic and we were, well, I wouldn't say ridiculed, but we were criticized for proposing. There was guys that wanted to go for broke yet, you know, in spite of everything, because the hardcore of the fighters were there. And those were the guys that wasn't going to scare and that knew what the score was and were prepared to go for broke to get it. Now, the other provisions of Donahue were that everybody that was on the payroll as of the day of the strike, I don't know, the 15th or the 16th, would be eligible to vote. In the Hawes-Dunnigan proposal, it was, I think, to be 3 days after we returned to work. Donahue said 10 days. The election had to be conducted within 10 days from the date the strike was settled. And it would be done on the basis conducted by the labor board. The other item, basic argument in the Donahue agreement was the arbitration of wages. And I think that's basically what I remember of the Donahue agreement and the points where it might have varied with the Hawes-Dunnigan agreement.
Well, that's a very good review. review of that.
Huh?
That's a very good review of the two. Now, when you look back, do you think that the union should have pressed for more, or do you think that the time had come?
Well, I propose to accept the Donahue proposal. I spoke for it in the hall. All the officials of the union, Bill Brown, Frozy, Grant Dunn, Mickey Dunn, Ray Dunn, Dobbs and Scoglin, Mohawk, all agreed that the union could live with that settlement. Because what it meant basically, the Donahue Agreement meant basically, well, indirectly, but it was more definite than the Hawes-Dunnigan, that we would be recognized by the union. And it was pointed out by Farrell that the employers had definitely now agreed to a standard minimum set of wages in the industry, to be improved, the possibility of being improved by an arbitrator. And it was pointed out by Scoglin that we were not relying on arbitration. And to this day, I don't believe in arbitration, except when it's mutually agreeable. And I don't believe in forced arbitration of anything in the respective labor contracts. And Carl pointed out that what we were going to determine with an arbitrator, that his role was going to be restricted to the question of wages. And we entered it on that basis. We had a demand, I think, of 55 or 60 cents an hour, and we went back to work with 52 and a half cents, or 50 cents. Yeah, it was 52. I believe it was 50 cents and 40 cents that we settled them. And the arbitrator raised it to 52 and a half and 42 and a half.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, we got a windfall out of him. But that's a little bit later, too. But we proposed that we accept the settlement. We were convinced, and I told you earlier that in one time, Dobbs, who's a very logical guy and does things with figures all the time, he figures things out too. He, speaking for the committee, had determined that we'd win a majority of the men in the industry. He also pointed out that we would probably lose certain barns. And some there would be no contest in. That was Farrell's cold-blooded analysis, and he was right on the money almost when the election was counted and the returns were in. He had figured this out earlier, and we proposed that we accept it. We said the union can live with it. If we get recognition, and we got the strength of the union, and we got the major portions of the men are solid in the big barns, we can bring up the rest of the industry by their bootstraps. And history proved that we did.
So it was, by that time, excuse me, it was an agreement that you felt you could go forth with and then win an election on.
Well, it was, yes. And it was calculated by the leadership, as they explained to the strike committee, it was a calculated decision which did not include that the men were worthy of getting a hell of a lot more than what we got out of the agreement, but it was a cold-blooded, logical, calculated decision that we could take it and live with it. And that's what we did.
Now you said that Dobbs very calculatedly figured out which barns would vote for the union and which would vote against.
That's right.
What reason did he have to believe that a particular barn would not go with the union? Did it have anything to do with the employer, or did it have more to do with the workers at the barn?
It had more to do with the workers in the particular barn. Certain of the barns were solid. Some were, not as solid. And some were lukewarm. But we had representation in all the places. Now, one place that we figured we'd lose, and we did, was the hatch package delivery. We lost that. I think the vote at the Dayton Company was very close. And I don't recall whether we won or lost there. We had a lot of good men in the Dayton Company. But we had a lot of guys that were not so good. And then we had...
Your barn?
Huh?
How about your barn?
Cameron?
Cameron.
We had four scabs down there.
Uh-huh.
Or three that worked.
How did you let them squeak in there?
How did we let them squeak in?
Yeah.
Well, they had been employed there prior to the strike.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was, there were two brothers, Alvin Journalin and Swede Journalin. And Alvin was a pathetic soul. He wanted to be a road driver, and he didn't have the capability. He was a small man. He had a real vision problem, and he couldn't handle the job, and he agreed to work during the strike. Donald Cameron was the son of Mac Cameron. He was a dispatcher there. He was part of the family. And he was a theological student that would never swear. He'd go, when something got the best of him, he wouldn't swear. And there was one other fellow that I lost track of now, what his name was. But outside of that, that barn was, this guy was worked in the warehouse, and he was an off and on guy.
How many people were in that barn?
Oh, God, I don't know. There's a lot of people there. I forget what the count would be when we voted.
Like a couple hundred?
Oh, no. No, it was, God, no, I don't remember. See, the list that was given to us to vote on, those that had been employed, as I told you, the snake room attitude made that workforce fluctuate up and down. But I believe that the Cameron vote at that time, well, it was a large company. It was primarily a household goods moving company and freight. They were one of the larger companies, but they were not the largest. And I imagine that the vote in that company ought to be around 80 to 100 men that we voted. Pratt's Express was a big company.
What was that?
Pratt's, P-R-A-T-T-S. Mm-hmm. And they were almost strictly freight. And they had a big inner city movement. They had trucks running to St. Paul, and they done a lot of much more heavy hauling than any other company in town. Although there were specialists like Lambert and Widome, they were heavy hauling contractors. Some of the companies, you see, they specialized in things. Now, Armstrong was a big company, and they done heavy hauling, and they had dump trucks. Cameron had no dump trucks. Other companies had dump trucks. Cameron had none. Cameron would do certain heavy hauling, but we weren't set up for heavy hauling. Cameron was a warehouse and furniture warehouse and a member of Allied Van Life. LaBelle Transfer was one that we figured we would lose, and we did lose. And they were strictly furniture. They would move in an office job something that was heavy hauling, but generally they weren't set up to do it. They were household goods. But
was there any logic then to which barns went against and which barns went for the union?
How do you mean by logic?
Well, I meant in terms of what they hauled or...
No. It was mostly the temper of the men that were working there and how much the employer had been able to ingratiate himself with the men, you know. The employer had the powers of Christ prior to 34, you know. He told you when to come and when to go and what to do when you were there. And God help you, you said anything. So we knew that we wouldn't stand too much of a show at Mabel. We felt we'd get quite a few men, which we did, but I think we lost the majority there. I think we lost the majority at, I'm not sure about Dayton's. Donaldson's fleet was real small. They weren't a factor. And some of the department stores, like Powers and the Leader, which later become Rectors, I don't know what they are now, they had small fleets. We figured those barns were questionable.
If you lost a whole, if in a particular barn there were more workers who were against the union than for the union, did you lose the votes of the workers who were for the union?
No. We could represent our, you know, if there was any argument there about our people getting kicked around, but the employer was bound to pay the wages and the rates and the conditions of the agreement. But the union took the position that we're going to represent our members, although I think the strict language of the agreement said that we did not have the bargaining rights at where we didn't win the barn. But the company had to recognize that the agreement did exist. But I believe after the settlement, when they had the test case, most of them agreed to go along without contest. Because Murphy Transfer and Storage, they moved to St. Paul shortly after. We won the Murphy barn. That was a big barn. They were up on 9th Street, 4th Street and 9th Avenue. Cameron was on 4th Street. Well, the address was 756 North 4th. But Murphy was up another block. Widholm was in there. And most of the barns we won. The big ones. Now, some of the little family barns, we knew we wouldn't get it. There was no, well, we call them a no-contest barn. They're predominantly family. And little places like Loring Transfer that handles four or five men and things like that that splice themselves into the agreement. We weren't concerned. Farrell was very objective about it. He said, the factors in the industry are we're going to control, and it turned out the way Farrell had it figured. We won the majority of the men. We won the majority of the barns.
Now, in this period after the strike, or once the settlement was reached, and before the election, did the union do a lot of campaigning? Was there time? How did they go about it?
Well, naturally, the guy's going back on the job. Now, when we speak about the union, we have to remember that that strike, I don't suppose it's had its counterpart many times, if ever, since, and maybe not before. But because of the broad infiltration of everybody into the conduct of the strike, the activity of the union officials on the one hand as against the union members, if that's, or is that what you're talking about? Most of the men, when we went back to work, by God, we're going to win this election, and we started arguing with all the guys that had returned to work. Now, I pointed out the three that I remember that went to work at Cameron. And there was a mechanic that returned to work down there. I forget what his name was, but we didn't have the... He wasn't what we called a back shop mechanic. He was strictly a truck mechanic. And we didn't have him included in the bargaining unit. But I think he went back to work somewhere along the line. Anyhow, the men in the union, they went gung-ho to make sure that everybody got out and voted. And of course, the leaders, the officials of the union, have really had their hands full. Goddamn Cliff Hall raised his bald head in the act again, and he was trying to now demonstrate that he was the business agent. And he was now that the strike was settled and all that the strike authority that had been granted to the negotiating committee and the likes of that had ended with the ending of the strike, and of course that wasn't about to happen. But the union itself, of course, that was the main topic. We'll beat them in the election. And there was all sorts of activity going on by the foot soldiers in the union, the members of the union. And we went back to work, and we'd get down on the freight lineups or the places that the truck drivers congregate, and we'd descend on some guy that was weak, and it went back to work, and ask him why he'd done it. And our theory was not to go back in there and slap him around, because we could have done that. Mm-hmm. It was easy, five or six guys get together and bully one guy. But we went there, as Carl Coughlin said, to make a Christian out of him. Mm-hmm. Carl wasn't a guy that put his faith in the Bible too much, but he said we'd make Christians out of the non-believers. And we did that. Everybody that we thought we was a... You see, a lot of the fellows didn't have the faith in the union that the others had. It was a hard thing to do after 5 years of that degradation, and I got a job. Now I'm back to work. What will happen? Will the union succeed? Will I be better off with the union? We convinced the guys that the union was the thing. And of course, the committee, which was at that time, Bill Brown was on the payroll, Dobbs, Ray Dunn, Mickey Dunn, Grant Dunn, they were on the payroll, and Dobbs. Skogie, the five of them, plus Bill Brown. George Froese was vice president of the union, and he went back to work at Swiller Transfer. That's where he was. And Swiller was a small company owned by Morris Swiller, a Jewish company. And Morris was a reasonable guy. You could talk to him and Izzy Wolk. But they were the fair-minded employer. I mean, you could talk with them. And it was more or less a little, almost a family thing at Swiller's and at Wolk and Elgin. Izzy had two companies. So at the bigger barns where there was doubt, we met the men. Now there was a difference. The drivers at the Dayton Company, the Donaldson Company, they'd come up, they'd load their truck in the morning. And they'd go out in the suburbs in the residential area, and they'd be by themselves all day. The only time that they come in contact with other drivers was when they'd meet them package drivers, or when they'd stop to have coffee or lunch at a given spot. But each one had a route, and he was busy working. He didn't get like we did, the freight drivers and the transfer drivers. We'd go down to the depots and we'd have to wait. There'd be a lineup. Everybody'd be outside of their truck yakking around, or we'd be waiting to load at the team tracks. And there was a congregation of people. And in that section, we were predominantly powerful because we were able in there to get the story out. And we won practically all the big major truck transfer barns, hands down. Now, that's about what I can remember about that period. If there's questions now, you sing out.
Okay.
I mean, about that particular issue, did the union do anything in that 10 days? You bet
right.
We did.
Yeah. Did you publish handbills? And
oh, the organizer was printed. They made two or three editions of the organizer.
What do you recall about press coverage at that time?
From the paper?
Yes.
Well, the press, like they'd always done, was always playing down the union. And I don't recall any real venomous articles at that time. Except they were carrying on this routine, the city's in the hands of communists, how do you like to have your streets run by Reds and the like of that.
They were doing this after the settlement?
Well, I don't know when they stopped. Mm-hmm. You know, they implied that right along, and as I say, I don't remember any venomous ads of that kind. But I imagine they were keeping something going.
Okay. During the summer, the Citizens Alliance would from time to time have radio broadcasts, and they would discuss the issues of the strike, and they would also publish ads, have ads published in the local newspapers.
Oh, yes.
Did they carry on any kind of this activity prior to the election?
As I said, off the top of my hat, I can't recall that there was any venomous activity.
By the Citizens Alliance.
Well, they were, I think, going out that there would be an election, it'll be fair, and we hope that they'll, you know. And I don't think there was too much, I don't recall. But it wouldn't be a simple matter on one of them papers by, you'd get an idea. The journal must be on, some of them, they must have them on microfilm.
I was just wondering in terms of what kind of impact that might have had on the people who were about to vote.
Well, I don't know. I think that when the strike was settled, it was such a relief to everyone that I don't know if they were real venomous or not. It seems to me a couple of times they were, but I can't, it's not coming clear to me now.
Mm-hmm. Well, how about in the barns? Do you have any idea, did you get any reports about employers trying to persuade their employees not to vote for the union?
Well,
were any deals made? You know, did they say, well, we'll raise your salary this much?
That we had a little talk with Joe Cochran. And Joe was no Einstein, you know. But he wasn't a complete dummy either. And he made a remark one day on the platform, well, he says, I hope when you fellas vote now that you'll do the right thing. And I jumped him. I said, what do you mean the right thing? I said, you got a book in our union? He says, no. Well, I said, well, don't come around here lending any lip service about the right thing then. I said, we know what we're going to do, and if I wouldn't have said that, there would have been a lot of other guys, but that fell on deaf ears.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm quite well convinced that in some of the barns, old man LaBelle, for one, might have come out and told the fellas that you're a little bit different type of guy, you're a lot of more long distance than the city driver, and you've got your own way to go. And they had some guys over there that were more, see, some of those long distance furniture movers were more or less on their own. And they were away from the city quite a bit. And they had a kind of a semi-managerial job, you know. They had to look after the truck, and if it was broke, they had to get it refixed and so forth. And I suppose in some of those companies, there was some pressure put on some of the men. I wouldn't rule that out. But if we found out any campaigning, I'm sure that there would have been a little confrontation about it. Why? It seemed to me that what we were concerned about more was making sure that everyone had a chance to vote. And of course, I believe that the employers getting back to work, putting their house in order, trying to get picked up. You know, that city had actually been on strike from May until almost the 1st of September. Mm-hmm. That little brief truce in between May and July strike, you know, they were getting gearing up, and they were now figured the thing is over, and we got to sweep out the parlor and dust the furniture and let's get going. Mm-hmm. And employer first is guided by his own profit motive. And they were making sure that they didn't lose any accounts and get back any that might have, you know, disappeared. And they were forced, you know, with competition. St. Paul was not on strike. And in this period of time, why, there'd been, no doubt, some sub rosa deals made where employers conducted business in the city of St. Paul through other trucking companies that we weren't able to put our fingers on. And they were now getting everything to come back to Minneapolis, and some people indicated that they weren't going to stay around Minneapolis. There was going to be a lot of labor unrest, and they were busy telling their clients and customers that they were here to stay and the strike was over. And they didn't have a hell of a lot of time. They only had 10 days.
Okay, that's interesting. I was wondering about that, because you hear so often today where an employer, when faced with the possibility of having a union shop, will instead offer to his employees the same wage that is being
offered
in the shop. And I wondered if there was any of that kind of activity going on back then.
Well, I didn't recall that. And one of the reasons, now the employers in Minneapolis were capable of that. But like anything else, you know, you learn to crawl before you walk. They had never had to deal with unions before, and this was something new to them.
And that's a technique that they would not.
This is a sophisticated technique that come with the passage of the Taft-Hartley Act.
I see.
You know, where you got rights under the law now.
Mm-hmm.
And their rights are, no, boy, they're pretty vicious. In that thing I sent you, didn't I send you the deal about the fights the Teamsters are having in North Carolina?
Yes, you did.
Well, there is evidence of it.
Mm-hmm.
What they do, put on a, call them in and pay them overtime in the morning and give them a 17-minute film and news broadcast of strikes and what happens, and there was none of that, not that I know about. Now, there could have been, but I didn't know about it. I know there was none where we were working, because if that would have started, there'd have been a Donnybrook right then.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Mm-hmm. That was a good, solid barn.
Well, it looks to me like we've covered pretty much the provisions of the agreement, and also we've talked about the election results, I would say. I would, since we're kind of running out of time on this tape, I would like to hold off for our next conversation your role as a judge in the election.
No, I don't think you're exactly right, as I remember.
No?
I was an observer.
You were an observer. Okay.
Now, I think the judges were the labor board personnel.
Okay. So we should replace the word observer for judge.
Yeah, I think that was it. We were not the judge. The Hennepin County Labor Board with Neil Cronin was the chairman.
Yes.
And I think they set in the judges.
Mm-hmm.
That were supposed to be fair and impartial in their long black robes, that they didn't have them on. We were the observer. And there were three from us and three from the employer.
Well,
plus the judges, and I think the judges were three or four in number as well.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that next time I give you a call, okay?
All right.
And go into that. So we still have some more questions to finish up on. Hopefully sometime soon, maybe also in our next discussion, you can give us some profiles on some of those people that I've mentioned in question 46, Harry DuBois and Ray Rainbow.
Oh, yeah. I don't think that's going to be much of a job.
Well, Well, yeah, that's going to be really interesting to hear about that.
Yeah.
We can also, you know, it looks as though we're going to be talking for a few more hours at any rate.
Mm-hmm. No, that's okay with me.
Well, good. Well, I hope that, I hope you'll be feeling okay.
Oh, yes. Well, yeah, I want to feel good. I'm just too ornery to do anything else.
Hmm? Well, that's good. Just continue to be ornery. I want to tell you, too, that hopefully today I will be sending out to you three of the interviews that have been transcribed.
Oh, fine.
I have wanted to go over them and
mm-hmm.
to make my marks in them so that
it's
very legible so that you can see them.
Mm-hmm.
I'll send you a letter with it. And I'm also sending you, I'll send you a copy of my editing symbol so you know what I mean when I make the little
Are you following the regular proofreader's marks, or you got your own course?
I would say that they generally are proofreader's marks, but I'll send you my little key anyway, just so that you can, you're sure of what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be possible for us to talk 2 weeks from tomorrow as opposed to 2 weeks from today?
Thursday?
Yeah.
No, I have no preference. Let's see, what's Thursday going to be then?
Thursday would be the 29th.
Wait a minute, I reach a calendar over here. That's going to be when?
That would be Thursday the 29th.
The 29th. Yeah, that's okay with me. I don't have anything scheduled. I have to go to the doctor on the 20th.
Okay.
Back to the clinic again, and then I have another appointment on the 4th of November. I mean, the 4th of December.
Okay.
So that would be then on... November 29th.
Yeah, that's Thursday, November 29th.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll call you at 11 o'clock our time.
That'll be 9 a.m. here.
Okay, good. Well, you take care of yourself, and
yeah.
I'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
Now, let's see, I sent you the remarks I made on Hoffa, didn't I? At the art convention in Honolulu, and the talk I made about Angela Davis.
Yes, uh-huh.
Now, none of those things are prepared speeches, you know. The way we operate pretty democratically, and if you got something to say, and I was forced to.
They seem very articulate, and to me they seem very articulate and very, very sincerely felt.
Well, they were.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about Angela Davis was there were certain people that had been alluding that because the judge. Was such a sanctimonious and a person that can't be touched by mortals, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I remember a few things that judges have done in this country that I don't agree with. They sentenced Sacco and Vanzetti to death.
Mm-hmm.
And a few more people, the Rosenbergs, and a few more.
Mm-hmm.
And judges have always been right. They're human beings and they're subject to error.
Mm-hmm.
So, I had to make my points about it, and I'm not concerned because Angela Davis was a member of the Communist Party, or that she was a black, or that she was a woman. As a person, she's entitled to the same rights everyone else is getting.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, I had to say what I said.
Well, I thought that that was very clear in your I thought that was very clear in your address to the convention.
You know, you want to remember the International Longshoremen's Union, the honky, the white man is a minority. We are the minority because of the large Hawaiian delegation
mm-hmm.
and the tremendous amount of Chicanos and blacks, because our union picked up those that other unions felt weren't worthy of membership,
mm-hmm.
the guys in the junkyards and the things like that. And so those jobs are generally reserved for the people that are in the minority group.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, then I'll plan to hear from you on November 29th.
Okay, thank you very much.
Eva, you're welcome.
Happy Thanksgiving.